Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it feels counterintuitive, like the nightingale, a bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm so glad that you could join me today. How are things? Summer holidays, a bit of a distant memory already as you get back down to work or back to school? Time's really speeding up, isn't it? Have you noticed? I'm certainly finding it a challenge to keep up sometimes. I've also noticed more and more people itching to change how they turn up in the world. The problem is working out how to do that in a world that's changing so fast. Well, today's show highlights two women with books aimed at helping us navigate a more balanced life. Later, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show life coach and author Michelle Ellman, who has a new book out that's primarily for children. But first, are you looking for a different way of balancing your life? A way to be that allows you to manage stress better and give you more satisfaction. Step forward, Christina Wallace, a senior lecturer at Harvard Business School in the United States, an angel investor and author of The Portfolio Life, Future-Proof Your Career, Craft a Life Worthy of You. She describes herself as a Venn diagram, having created a career or life at the intersection of business, technology, and the arts. All this and being a mother too. As someone who barely followed a traditional career path in life myself, I was delighted to meet Christina and hear about her experience and how she pivoted, as they say, to create a life that suits her. Well, Christina, you have come to this, I suspect, well, I know because I read the introduction to your book, come to this because you are facing the challenges that an awful lot of us are facing right now. And you had to change the way you worked. So tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, this is a model based off of the challenges that I've always had in my career. I've been multidisciplinary since I was in primary school and have sought to build a multidimensional life with lots of different income streams and interests and hobbies from the get-go. And I somewhat joke that I wrote this book to explain to my mother what it is that I've been doing all these years. But I also came about to writing this book because I faced this moment as I became a mother a few years back and wanted to shift into having young children, where I recognized I needed to make a dramatic rebalancing of my portfolio, of my commitments, my allocation of time and talents. And I wanted to do that really in an intentional way for this season of life, that my ambitions are still there. They're just in different dimensions. And so I needed to rebalance and sort of that juxtaposition of two ideas that I've always been multiple things and I can go through seasons where those multiple things are going to shake up a little bit. Those two ideas together brought me to this point of saying, let's put all of these frameworks and tools that I've developed for myself over the years. Let's put them all together in a bit of a manual that's part permission for others who have been wanting to go down this path and part process of how do you actually do that?
Well, I think that's perfect. A, the permission piece, because although things have very much changed in the work environment lately, even more so in the last few years, right? A lot of people still need the permission to go down this alternative path of having a portfolio career. And even if they felt that they were permitted to do so, how do you start? So I think it's great that you've brought this book out and you have it split into three parts, the why, the what, and the how. So let's talk a little bit about the why then. Let's just paint a picture of where we are right now in the workplace. And I know that you speak from an American perspective, but it's pretty universal.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a, it feels like a distinct moment in time where the trends of the last few years are speeding up as we layer on additional disruptions, right? So we have seen, call it the last 20 years or so, this increased rate of sort of things coming out of left field, if you want to imagine it like that. Anything from financial crises to ecological climate change crises, down to geopolitical crises, and things that might used to be like a once in a lifetime or once in a generation kind of movements, changes, now seem to be happening every like 2 to 5 years. Then we layer on a pandemic, which changes how everyone works. And now we've added on technology with AI and generative AI and ChatGPT that is just going to snowball these changes. So the new normal is one where this rate of change like is part of what we live in. And so it makes it harder to think about a linear path for even 10 years, let alone a full career, the 40-year career that my mother thought about or that my grandfather thought about. And as a result of these changes, you have to really be thoughtful about what are all of the skills and networks and talents that I could bring to the table professionally. And how might I think about building this career in chapters? Because the long path, I can't tell you what that looks like at all. So let's just think in shorter seasons. What comes next? What do you want to learn? Who do you want to learn it from? And which of your things do you want to bring to bear? And if you have multiple irons in the fire, probably all the better from a place of diversification.
Yes, and it isn't necessarily anything that you have been, I don't want to say training is bad. This isn't what I'm saying, but it's not necessarily something you've been trained to do. It may be that you have a passion and you can actually monetize that, and you can do that simply in different ways. Mm-hmm. The ways that we were traditionally taught was business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think the old model was you study something at university, you pick your career, and that's the only thing you are qualified to do.
Right.
And that's the only thing that you are have permission to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And for good or for bad, that since that is no longer viable, I think I've seen certainly as I look at my students at Harvard and the career paths that my friends and the folks that I interview and do research on for the point of the book, there is a need to and a willingness to look outside of your training, outside of your resume, and say, well, what all do you bring to the table? Are you an incredible storyteller alongside being an accountant? Are you someone who thinks about creating as well as managing, right? What are the things that you love, the skills you bring, and even the curiosities? What are the things that you are open to learning along the way? Because we recognize that 3 or 4 years at university at the start of a career is no longer the training that will keep you afloat for 40 years. So we're constantly having to learn. And so the upside to that is there's a ton of permission for zigzags and for excavating kind of all these other parts of you that you might have thought, well, that's my hobby. That's my fun thing, but that's not who I am. No, it is. And you're allowed to bring that forth.
Yes, it's all who you are. Mm-hmm. And you can bring all of it to bear in terms
Absolutely.
Of your career or mm-hmm. how you do your work. I never really like to distinguish between work and life. You know, we always used to talk about work-life balance. And I always used to shake my head and say, but it's all just life.
Yes, it is. Life. It is. Which is why I called the book The Portfolio Life rather than The Portfolio Career. Because I think work is in the context of your life.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about a financial portfolio, you often imagine it, you know, drawn out like a pie chart, and you've got, you know, a certain allocation to stocks and to bonds and to real estate and to cash. And it's the same as you think about your portfolio life, your allocation to work, your allocation to your career, your friends, your community, your family, your health, your personal time. All of that has to add up to 100% of your capacity, right? Like that, it has to be in the context of what you are able to give. And if other parts of your life suddenly start making meaningful demands, as they will in different seasons, it is absolutely reasonable, understandable to reallocate how much you give to work and to think about this in a way. This is how you prevent burnout, where you don't imagine that work can always be the same piece. And that, you know, if suddenly your parents or your children or your own health starts to take a larger portion of your attention, that you're not making adjustments commensurately.
Thank you. I was about to say that, you know, if anybody's sitting at home or wherever you're listening to this, scratching your head and thinking, what has this got to do with health? Well, it's got everything to do with health, actually,
it does.
Because, you know, if you're not working in a way that is good for you, working for you, good for you, mm-hmm. that's fitting in with your life and the demands of your life, then it's mm-hmm. stressful.
Yes. Yes. And that is what leads to burnout. When you have, if you think about that portfolio, that allocation, when you have allocated more time and capacity than you have to give, you will burn out. That's how the math works. And I think we don't often look at the full allocation of our life when we're thinking about, have I taken on too much or is this sustainable? You know, we are often just looking at work without taking into account what are the other things on our plate that we care about, that we want to give that time to. And even within that allocation, you know, I make this argument in the last third of the book when we get into time management, that really 100% is not the allocation you'd be thinking about. It's 85%. You should be maxing out as you are divvying up your time and attention and talents to think about on a day-to-day basis, only 85% has been accounted for, has been spoken for. To leave yourself that buffer of 15%, and there's research I point to where that number came from, but give yourself that buffer that allows for do-overs, mistakes, life. It allows for serendipity. And crucially, it allows for rest, right? Yeah. This is where you prevent against burnout, where you give yourself capacity to just rest, which is at least in the US, this is not something that we are accustomed to.
Exactly. Exactly. You have a different work culture there, but even so in the UK, it can be very challenging to find rest if you're working in particular jobs. Mm-hmm. But as you were talking there, it was reminding me of friends in the past. And when I walked away from journalism, television journalism, I was working for, you know, an international news organization here in the UK, or a number of them, in fact. And I decided that it wasn't doing me any favors and that I needed to step away. And how many of my friends said, I wish I had the courage to do that. Well, it, you know, it wasn't really much to do with courage. It was like, am I going to just die on my feet or am I going to find something else? Right.
Yes.
But then, you know, they would say, I'd say, well, you can't. And they would say, well, no, well, what would I do? I said, there's a whole world out there of stuff that you can do. And, but, you know, there's always the, because they didn't feel they had permission to walk away from what they'd actually set their identity in line with. And then, you know, I remember one person saying to me that she would love to just, you know, step away. And she would love to have her own little saddlery company. And I said, well, why don't you? Oh, no, I couldn't do that, you know. And this was her hobby. She loved doing, you know, leather work and saddlery. She was a horse rider. And she just couldn't see herself in any way doing that in any other form than as a hobby.
Yeah. Which is frustrating because, as you point out, identity, and this is, you know, as I outline kind of the pillars of how to make this life work for you, it all starts from a place of identity.
Yeah.
And identity comes down to the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, right? Who am I? And you recognize that there are, if you really sit down and examine it, there are stories that are maybe out of date. That you're telling yourself, things that maybe you're repeating that other people said about you, and you said, oh, you know, I'm not creative. Well, based on what evidence? who put that idea in your head? Oh, I could never take the risk of being an entrepreneur. Really? You don't take risks anywhere in your life? Is Is this beyond your capacity to think about that risk in a really smart, structured way? So if you start from this identity, that is what gives you permission to either think very broadly about what you can do or very narrowly. And if, you know, saddlery, leatherwork, horse riding is part of who she is, and it sounds like it is, it's a hobby, it's something meaningful to her, it is only a tiny stretch to go from a hobby to a profession if you believe you are allowed to.
Yeah.
So it starts from a place of understanding and really excavating your identity. And sometimes you can do it through self-reflection. And sometimes you have to go and ask the people around you who they see when they look at you. And you might recognize that others are giving you permission to do these things, and you're the only one that is keeping you from doing it. So I really encourage folks to start from this place to say, I am not how I currently monetize my time. Like, my job today is not who I am. What other things are in, as I call it, my Venn diagram of what makes you you? What are the other skills, interests, curiosities, networks that you bring to bear, and that by going off in a different direction and making use of a different part of yourself, you have incredible optionality as to how you might build the next season of your life?
Yes, that's the first step, isn't it? But let's just step away from Christina for a moment, as it's time for a short break. We'll be back right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Christina Wallace. And I thought we'd better make one thing clear as we talk about work.
We're not saying to anybody, just leave your job.
No,
and do something else, right? We're not saying that, are we? Nobody in their right mind should do that. I might have done it once or twice in my life, but, you know,
sure,
it's not recommended. But what we are saying is, you know, have a review of your life.
Yes.
And what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. Are you feeling stressed? Is it too much for you? Mm-hmm. Are you getting the right balance? Do you feel ill, like I did?
Yes.
And realize that actually this isn't sustainable any longer. This has to stop, right?
And those are often the signals, right? When people ask me, like, when should I be thinking about making a change? Well, how do I know when the seasons change? You know, because there is friction in your life. You know, I knew leading up to when I was having my first child, I was in a role at a company where I was so stressed. My blood pressure was through the roof. I had to take anxiety medication to go to leadership team meetings because I literally had to sedate myself because they were so stressful. And my physician, my GP was asking me, you know, every time she's like, I know you exercise. I know you're eating right. Like, why do these numbers not make sense? Your body is telling you something is wrong. And that was really the wake up call for me. It wasn't even the mental stress. It was, I'm about to tax my body even further to get pregnant, to have a child, to go through postpartum recovery. And I need to be in the best place for that. And I am not in the best place for that right now. And this is not a place where I want to come back to with a young child who's going to depend on me when I can't even like get through the day unmedicated before that stress, you know, comes. So often it is like taking stock of, what do I need? Are those needs being met? What do I want for my life? Am I actually getting to pursue any of those, you know, those wishes, those dreams on the day in and day out? Not everything is going to be, you know, dreamy every day, but am I even going roughly in the direction that I say I want for my life? And then am I actually taking advantage of and getting to use the pieces of who I am. I think sometimes, certainly, I advise folks early in their career, in their 20s, where they feel frustrated because their superpower, as they have come to discover, I'm really great at this, is not wanted or valued or even on the table at the job they're in or in the company they're in. And so they think, you know, I'm sort of underperforming at what they're asking me to do. I could overperform, but they don't want that. Yeah. I'm like, great. So make a change. Find the rooms that want what you have to offer.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's great advice. And I think a lot of us will have experienced that, where we are suddenly mm-hmm. realizing that our true potential isn't valued. Mm-hmm. And we can't even express it properly yes. in the job that we're in. Yes. Yeah, that's so important. And so then that's the first step, is the realization and mm-hmm. the trying to identify what direction or directions, plural, you'd mm-hmm. want to go in. Yes. So then what's the next part of the process, would you say?
Yeah. It's going to be a little different for everyone, depending on your circumstances. But I outline a couple of different, I call them business models for your life, right? I'm a business school professor. That's the perspective I come from.
Yeah.
But different ways to think about, how do I make money, meet my needs, still have kind of the pieces of my portfolio? And there's a different couple of models that you can think about. One, the moonlighting model, is often where you have the day job, and then you have something on the side. That something on the side might be monetized. It might be, you know, your side hustle, your small business, your consulting practice, your whatnot. But it might just be a very serious hobby that you love and that you want to put meaningful time in. I often see this for people who have a creative pursuit. They are make art or write or perform in a band, and they say, I don't want to try to support my life financially through that endeavor. I know it's probably not going to work. So I'm going to find a good enough day job that is not fulfilling my wishes and dreams, but it is funding my wishes and dreams. And that's where I really get that fulfillment in the moonlighting piece. The second model, the zigzag, often grows out of moonlighting, where maybe that thing on the side that was a hobby or even a side hustle becomes the thing that you then go all in on. Maybe you've de-risked this idea of a small business. You start doing it, you make a little bit of money, you work out the kinks of how the business model would work, and you suddenly recognize there's a lot of demand for what I have. I love doing this as a job, not just a hobby, and I can support my life through that. And that's when you leave the day job, or sometimes the day job becomes the side hustle. You downgrade into freelancing or contract work just enough to keep funding the transition, and you let the side hustle become the day job. And on the surface, it looks like a zigzag. People are like, you were a journalist and now you make saddles. And you're like, yeah. But underneath, I've been seeding this transition for years. It makes sense. And then the last model, the multi-hyphenate, is where you have multiple things you do at once and they're all really visible. This is often something where you might see an author, speaker, podcaster, right? Different lines of work that all feed into each other. Or I give some examples of the book of things that make no obvious connection. A playwright who also writes computer code in a programming job at a software startup, right?
Now that's made my head go a bit.
What's fascinating about these people who live in these seemingly unconnected worlds at once is often they become the vanguard for innovation. They are sitting in these worlds and they can start seeing connections that other people don't. So this friend who's a playwright and a computer programmer got invited by TED, the TED conference, to join their residency program to research and write about art in the age of AI.
Wow.
What does it mean if the computers are making art? Do we even call it art? Who owns that IP? Who owns that art, right? And she, as a technologist and playwright, is uniquely positioned to have a point of view on this.
Yeah, absolutely. So much has opened up in many ways, actually, mm-hmm. you know, in the last few years. I know a lot has closed down, but yes. it's the traditional stuff that's been closing down. Mm-hmm. And if we allow our imagination to just, you know, come out a little bit more, mm-hmm. and we allow, we give ourselves the permission. All these things are coming, you know, coming to us, aren't they?
Yes.
All kinds of different things can come to us. And that's pretty left field, but, you know, yeah.
It is. And I think this is where, you know, it comes back to identity. I was advising one woman who took 15 years off of her career to raise a family, mm-hmm. and was looking to get back into the workforce. And she started from a, well, I used to be an events planner and a marketing team. And I understand I'll have to, you know, start at the beginning again because I've been out of the industry for 15 years. And I was like, wait, you haven't been not doing anything for 15 years. You've been the best chief of staff to the most high maintenance executive team. You've learned how to meet deadlines, stay on budget, manage all of these different moving pieces, deal with very difficult personalities. I mean, you made it through the teenage years, right? So don't discount this lived experience as you think about your next role, and don't default to the job that you had 15 years ago as the only place you're qualified to re-enter the workforce. Lovely. And in doing this conversation, she realized she actually was well positioned to go out for chief of staff roles to CEOs. And she landed a fantastic job doing so in a much higher salary bracket than she thought she would re-enter in. But it required her to acknowledge her lived experience is just as valid as her professional experience and her training was 15, 20, 30 years ago.
I love that you said that. I really love that you said that, because so many people do themselves down. Mm-hmm. They haven't been in the workplace for any length of time, you know, 15 years, your friend. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, what can I do now? Well, what have you been doing for the last however long?
Exactly.
You know, you've been navigating your way through life. And it reminds me of another friend years ago who worked for an NGO, and she basically was a project manager. She oversaw projects, you know, around the world, staffing elements, you know, funding elements, all of that. And I remember her saying to me one day, but I don't know what else I can do. I said, for heaven's sake, you know, look at your qualifications, look at what you're doing now. That is so transferable.
Yes.
To anywhere.
Yes. And so my advice to folks who are in that position, when they're like, I want to maybe try something else, but I don't know where my things translate. Grab coffee with friends, with friends' friends, with the friends of your parents, your spouses, whatever. Meet as many people as you can who live in these different worlds, who work in these other areas, and ask them to help you translate your experience into the jargon and the sort of the bigger ideas that will go beyond your exact, you know, industry that you've been from. Because, I mean, jargon is the thing that keeps us siloed. Yes. You know, if you look at a TV news resume, it's going to have very specific words that mean something in the news world and mean nothing to anyone outside of it. But if you tell me, no, I investigate, I research, I write, I do stories, I do, you know, source management, right? Lots of people skills, right?
Like
you find ways to translate that. Then you could say, oh, you might be fantastic for a communications job. Have you thought about going into content marketing, right? What are other ways that you can put, do you want to teach and facilitate many of those skills, right? There, everything is transferable if you can get one level above the jargon.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Understanding the language that the other party needs to hear.
Yes.
In order to hear you.
And that becomes the signal to them that not only am I going to be, you know, useful, my skills translate, but also I understand this enough that I know what I'm getting into. I think that's sometimes the big fear when you're hiring a career switcher, to say, well, even if you can do the job, do you know what you're signing up for? Do you understand this industry, the pace, the culture, the pitfalls, like, or is there going to be like a bit of an organ rejection? And if you can show up with that jargon, with that storytelling of how you fit, you're also demonstrating, I've done the legwork. I know what I'm signing up for. This is, in fact, what I want.
Great, great advice there. That's a great takeaway for anyone listening. And, you know, also in the book, when you go into the how, you're also giving great advice on how to work out how much you need budgeting, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So you do give a lot of very practical help, as one would expect from somebody who is a lecturer at Harvard Business School. But, you know, crunching the numbers, how to, you talked about how to manage your time. All these things are important, aren't they?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the entire last section comes from the perspective of, you have to think about yourself as the CEO of your life. Again, business analogies, but stick with me. The CEO of your life, you are in charge, right? And the more that you are not following a path that has been crafted before you, the more you have to take responsibility for how this all works. And that is both freeing, but also complicating in many ways. And so I step through this to say, you know, a CEO has a board of directors. They have people who advise them. You're not going to have a mentor keeping out an eye out for your career if you're not going step by step for 40 years up this ladder. So who do you need in your life to help advise you? And how do you think about those mentorships, those relationships over time? A CMO, a chief marketing officer, is going to be thinking about how do we tell the story and connect the dots. And this is the same here. You can't just hand your CV to someone and expect them to understand how one thing connects to another. You have to do the work of finding those connections, telling that story proactively, leaving the breadcrumbs to make it easy to follow. And then we get to managing your time like a chief operating officer, managing your money like a chief financial officer. It's a little bit hokey, I guess, but it's this idea that each of these components matter to having a sustainable life. You know, if you have the money, the emergency fund or the F-off fund, as I call it in the book, if you have that, that gives you the flexibility to make a change.
Yeah.
Without that, you're stuck. You can't leave. So how can you give yourself more of this flexibility, more of the space to understand what you need, make the shifts where you need them, and do it in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming? You're not just always adding and working 7 days a week, but you are intentionally designing a model that fits for the season that you're in.
Yes, and taking responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. I always talk about taking responsibility for your health, but this is the same thing.
Absolutely.
Right? Taking responsibility, not saying, okay, I go into work and my bosses are responsible for me at work. That's not how it works.
That's right. That's right. And there's more responsibility in this model than our parents had, but there's more freedom. There's more autonomy. There's more control in a world that really feels out of control sometimes. So I think, you know, there's the silver lining to this, you know, ridiculous rate of change that feels a little bit overwhelming sometimes. The upshot is we now have the permission, the tools, the space to imagine a very different model for our lives. And if you can do that and you put in the work, you actually are going to end up with a lot more control and autonomy.
You do. I love it. And what's going through my head again as you're speaking is, wouldn't it be great if Christina had a workshop or something like that that people could go to? Do you have anything like that?
I don't, but you are not the first to ask about it. So there's a very real chance I might be putting something together in the near future. Certainly, I wanted to make the book feel like a workshop with me. It's very hands-on. It's very practical. I recommend to most folks read it through once just to figure out what you're signing up for, and then grab your notebook or your stack of post-it notes and sit back down and work through it. And sometimes, you know, working through it with a friend, having someone else as you're bouncing these ideas off of each other is helpful. And, you know, you don't have to do it all in one day. It's overwhelming. Like, stage it out. But really, you know, the ideas are great, but you have to put in the work if you want to see the impact.
Oh, yeah. You always have to put some work in. Things don't just happen magically.
They don't.
Well, sometimes they do, but, you know, it's not really true life. We're not in a Harry Potter film here. But Yeah. So, Christina, it's been fantastic talking to you. I thought the book was brilliant.
Thank you.
And I'll actually be going through it again myself, because a portfolio career is something that I guess I've kind of had for a while, but not always as successfully as I would have wanted, mm-hmm. let's just say. I'll be working through the book. And seeing where, you know, where I could improve things, I think that would be.
I can't wait to hear how it goes.
Well, thank you so much, Christina. And if you ever do get those workshops together, let me know.
Will do. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
And you can find out more about Christina Wallace and her book at either www.christinawallace.com or www.portfololife.com. If you're looking to ride the changes we're all facing, the Portfolio Life might just be for you. Well, it's time to take another short break right now. We'll be back with my next guest, Michelle Ellman, right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station, with me, JJ, the practical alchemist. Now, to have that portfolio life that we were talking about earlier, it really helps to set boundaries. And my next guest, Michelle Ellman, is an expert when it comes to boundaries. Michelle is a 5-board accredited life coach, broadcaster, award-winning activist and influencer who's just had her first children's book published. It's called How to Say No, Setting Boundaries for Your Friendships, Your Body and Your Life. I just had to find out what prompted Michelle to write the book for such a young audience.
I think it was the fact that the first time I learned boundaries through my own life coach, was the first thought I had was, why didn't I get taught this earlier? How was I meant to know this without being taught this? And why isn't there enough of a conversation about it? Now there is a conversation about it. Most people understand the word boundaries, but I'm still not sure that people could put a definition to it, especially children. So it's all well and good talking about boundaries. It's now in the everyday conversation. But if you're a child, if you're 10 years old, how are you trying to set boundaries? And my biggest hurdle when setting boundaries was word for word what to say. I remember my life coach saying to me, well, why didn't you say you didn't want to do that? And I was like, I can't say that. She was like, you literally could have said, this doesn't work for me. And I was like, you know what? Obviously, I know all those words. I've just never thought to put those words together.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the issue, isn't it? That you know all the words and you maybe even know the principle of the thing.
Yeah.
But it's almost like getting the permission to put those words together and use them in that way.
Yeah, well, it's very similar to, you know, when you get all your girlfriends around and they construct texts for you in the early stages of dating.
Oh, yeah.
You don't really know how to talk in a flirty way, but then also not in too obvious a way, and all of this. It's the same thing with boundaries. You're learning a new language, and yes, you might know this doesn't work for me. You might know those words, but like how to actually string it into a sentence. Like my first reaction was, you can't say that, but you absolutely can. And I think knowing it younger makes boundaries the norm. And I think that's where I've always been passionate about working with children, actually, before I became a life coach. All of the jobs I had up to that were working with children. Working as a life coach with children is a little bit harder because it's not a protected term. And the qualifications are very vague depending on who's qualified. And so I stopped working with children, but I've always been passionate about it. And so it was just that thing of, let's give kids this tool, this resource I wish I had when I was younger, so that they can have it from as early an age as possible.
Yes, right. And of course, the other issue with children, right, is that they are at school, they have their parents, they're constantly being told or asked to do things by an authority figure. And yeah. So you don't You don't learn to set boundaries because you're always being, or you're always having them set for you, kind of, right?
And also you're always having, the best child or a child that is considered a good child is one who listens, submits, does everything that they're told, but that doesn't lead to a very good adult. Because if you're just complying to everyone around you, then fine, that might mean an easier child to parent, an easier child to teach. But then they get to adulthood and they need to have opinions when they're in meetings. They need to know how they feel so they can communicate it in romantic relationships. And none of childhood equipped you for that. So yes, it might be easier to parent a child. It might be harder to parent a child with boundaries, but that child is now set up for life.
Yes. I can see, though, that it would be very difficult to do that, and especially in a school situation as well, where you've got the whole class or community within the school to consider as well. So it would seem to me, and maybe quite a few listeners, that this is a really kind of fine line to tread here. So, yeah. So how do you approach that?
When I told my sister, who has three kids, who are all much too young to read the book, but the book's actually dedicated to them, that I was writing a book called How to Say No. And she was like, why do I need that book? I don't need my kids to say no any more than they already do. And I was like, I understand that when it comes to parenting, but you're thinking out of context, because you want them to be able to say no to their peers against peer pressure and things like that. And you also want them to be able to respect your no. So part of boundaries is good communication, and not just teaching them about boundaries, but these are your boundaries. Therefore, if you want people to respect your boundaries, you also need to respect other people's. So it's not about the kid gets their way all the time, or that you are compliant to all of their needs and wants. But you can say to a child, we can't stay at the playground. That's not an option. But thank you so much for telling me what you want. And it's good that you let me know. And we can consider next time staying a little bit longer. So even if you don't meet their boundaries every single time or what they want in that situation, you can still come at it with a place of empathy, congratulate them for vocalizing their needs, knowing what they want inside them. That is a tool that's going to be really helpful in adulthood. And then also say, that's not possible. Just like in adulthood, you can't always do what you want. And sometimes we have to do things that we don't want to do. But that doesn't mean that you speaking up or saying how you felt in the situation is a bad thing.
Yeah, so it is about communication. And I'm just, as you were speaking there, I was just going back to my own childhood and thinking, how was it for me? And it was very much a case of whatever I said wasn't really, it didn't really matter, right? Whatever opinions or thoughts I had, they didn't matter at all. They weren't considered, really.
Yeah.
It was what the parents wanted. It was how I should be at home, at school, wherever. So, and I think, thinking about my own life, it really didn't, as you're saying, set me up for a life at work and in general, so in relationships.
For me, it was that I was really scared of getting in trouble. So I was that kid who got A stars and never, like, to get a detention would have been my worst nightmare. But that meant when I went to university, I was so scared to talk to my my supervisor, because I saw them as an authority figure. And a lot of my friends got a lot more help in university because they felt because it was a very much you had to initiate relationship where, like, you had to go to ask them for help. You need to turn up to their office. You need to sit outside their office hours. And that initiation doesn't isn't something that happens when you're scared of authority figures. So this thing of, like, okay, I was a very compliant child, I did what I was told, meant that actually I didn't know how to ask for help when I needed it when I got to university. And that's not even proper adulthood. So if you aren't able to communicate in the workplace to your boss that you're unhappy or that your workload's too much or all of these things, that stems from what you were taught in childhood. So even if someone, when I was younger, was able to say, look, I understand why you're upset, just acknowledging how I felt. And I think how I initially learned about overriding my boundaries and how I felt and how I thought is an example I use in How to Say No, talking about food, where you have to eat food because it's polite, even if you hate that food. What that's teaching is disconnect from your body. It doesn't matter what you want. It doesn't matter what you dislike. It matters that you people please, that you are polite to other people around you. Well, if I don't like eating fruit, if I don't like eating berries and you make a berry tart, how is it personal? Like, it's not personal to you. I'm not like insulting your specific berry tart. It's that I don't like any berries. But then what am I meant to do? Sit at the table and eat it anyway? And actually, this story I tell, like, I was so adverse to berries that I usually threw up if I ate berries. And I was like, what's more rude, me not eating it, politely declining it, or me throwing up at the table? So it's not a malicious way that parents teach children to override their feelings in their body. It's usually something like that, which is taught as society's politeness. And then it builds this message of, it doesn't matter if you're uncomfortable, you shouldn't vocalize it. And then that's really important when it comes to later years in adolescence, especially around consent.
Yes. And I'm smiling at your story about berries. I had a similar reaction to a jam sandwich. And I was very, very little. I was at kindergarten, maybe even, or primary school anyway. And it was at a school lunch and we had to eat these things. And it was, I think, strawberry jam with butter on bread. And the combination, I just thought was disgusting. And I threw up.
Yeah.
And, you know, ever since then, I've always said, no, you know, I've never had the combination, never eaten the combination. But it, because I had such an extreme reaction, I felt I had permission to say, no, I don't eat that, or no, please don't make that for me. But of course, you know, it's appalling if we have to wait for something so extreme to happen before we feel that we have the permission to say, no, I don't like that. I don't want that.
Also, at that age, you were probably told, oh, you don't know what you like. You just need to try it a few more times. That's automatically the assumption that, and I understand children are still learning, they're still growing, but they have a better relationship with their body than most adults do. So telling them how they feel is not how they feel. If an adult said to you, I don't like berries, you would listen to the adult. So listen to the child. There might be ways you can sneak it into their food or whatever you want to do, but to unlearn the fact that a child knows their bodies and knows what they feel like is a very slippery slope when you get into adulthood and you can't feel any of your feelings because you've been so disconnected from your body.
That's such a good point. Yes, it is a really good point. And that disconnection leads to all sorts of other issues as well, doesn't it? So it's not just about being able to vocalize or verbalize how you feel about certain foods. It actually, you internalize it, and then it becomes an issue in terms of, you know, it can presumably lead to eating disorders and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think also when people think about, when parents react badly to the title of the book, I like to remind them the book covers everything. So it's things like boundaries online, which you want your kids to have, boundaries around body shame. So if they're experiencing any bullying in school, they know that their body is not the problem. And again, back to peer pressure thing. So these aspects will help. And also there's a section on siblings. So if your kids are going at each other, having boundaries with each other, like you can't just walk into my room and storm in when you want, and you have to respect a closed door means I want privacy. That those conversations should help sibling relationships as well.
And so it's not just for children, the book, it's for adults as well, in or anybody who's raising a child, right?
Absolutely. I think it's a great book to share as a family. And I've always said, when you set boundaries as a household, to include the children in the decision making, it's all well and good putting up a list of rules for the house, but if they're actually sat there coming up with the rules themselves, whether it's, if my door is closed, you have to knock, that's a simple boundary that doesn't necessarily change how things happen in the house, but will change how that child feels about their privacy.
Yeah, so it's empowering is what it is. And so you're raising a child who is far more empowered and far more capable of navigating life as an adult. Yeah, I completely see that. Well, well done on writing that book, Michelle. And so tell us where people can get a hold of it, where people can get in touch with you if they want to speak to you about any issues that they have.
Yeah, so it's in all good bookstores. So Waterstones, Amazon's, WH Smith's foils, they all have it. You can definitely get it online as well. And my social media handles are Michelle L. Elman, and I'm on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all the things.
Yeah, you're everywhere, basically. You're everywhere.
Too many places, yes.
No, I wouldn't say that. But no, so brilliant. So, it sounds like it's a really good read and easy to get a handle on as well. Easy to read because it is for children aged 11 upwards, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's very much aimed as that transition between primary school and secondary school, that kind of age group where they've gone from being the big fish in school to then suddenly being the bottom of the rung.
Yeah, and it is a difficult time as well because, you're going through puberty, you're going through all sorts of changes in your life. So it's very important, mm-hmm. actually, at that point to learn how to set boundaries. Yeah,
absolutely.
Brilliant. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking to me about it. I wish you well with the book. And as ever, you're always full of fantastic advice. And, it's great to speak to you as ever. So, I hope to have you back on again another time when the next book's out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I need to get working on that one, actually.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Always great to have Michelle Elman on the show. But that's nearly it for today. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed my guests as much as I enjoyed talking with them. Do check out their websites and my own website, thepracticalalchemist.uk, for more information. You can also find me as The Practical Alchemist on Instagram and Facebook. Remember, you can listen to all our shows on all the main podcast platforms these days. And if you like what you hear or they've helped you, do help us spread the word by sharing them. But I hope you'll join me again for more alchemy here on UK Health Radio. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.